Well, good evening, everyone. My name's Robin Archer and I'm the director of the Ralph Miliband program here at the London School of Economics. And I'd like to welcome you to our series of lectures on revolution. I should perhaps mention before proceeding any further, as I guess developments in the United States are weighing on a number of people's minds, that our next event next Wednesday will be about that. And we have a very distinguished panel considering what the meaning of that event is for the left. Tonight, however, it's my very great pleasure to introduce our extremely distinguished speaker, Professor Gareth Stedman-Jones. Gareth is the Professor of the History of Ideas at Queen Mary University in London, the Director of the Centre for History and Economics at Cambridge University, where he's been a Fellow at King's College for many years, and he's a founding editor of the History Workshop Journal and was for many years on the editorial board of New Left Review. His major interest has been in studying the history of political ideas in the period broadly from the French Revolution through to the First World War, and he has many publications, but I think he's especially well known for two books, Outcast London and Languages of Class, which have had a huge impact on the study of that topic. Well, he's just published his most recent book, Karl Marx, Greatness and Illusion, which I think draws on a lifetime of thought about the life and work of that ever so important thinker. And it's about that he's going to be talking to us today. Marx's Capital, Volume 1, as some of you may know, was published almost exactly 150 years ago today. And I'm very pleased, and I think we're very fortunate, to have such a distinguished speaker to talk to us about that eminent scholar. Well, Gareth is going to speak for about 50 or 55 minutes, and we'll then have plenty of time for question and discussion. But can I ask you to join me in welcoming our speaker, Professor Gareth Stedman-Jones.
Well, thank you very much. I knew Ralph Miliband, and many years ago I think I learnt quite a bit from his work on Marx. He's one of the first people who actually tried to intrude some academic sort of sense into the debates about Marx, and particularly his theory of the state. So in that sense, I feel some affinity to him, although I doubt that whether he would fully approve of what I'm going to say today. What I'm going to do is partly to explain why I've thought it an important theme in my book to separate Marx from Marxism. And so that will be the theme, and it will do so by separating, as it were, the ideas on history from the ideas on nature, which are very much conflated, I think, in what Marxism has been. One of the principal aims of my book, Karl Marx, Greatness and Illusion, has been to distinguish Marx from Marxism. As a result of 20th century revolutions, the rule of communist parties, and the ideological struggles of the Cold War, Marx became identified with Marxism, variously described as scientific socialism, historical materialism, or a determinist conception of history. Man was a product of nature, driven forward by natural forces. This picture is a fundamental misrepresentation of Marx's works, in particular his conception of the relationship between history and nature, which I'm going to talk about today. In fact, one of Marx's greatest contributions, I think, drawing upon Hegel and the German idealist tradition, was to demonstrate just how much mankind had shaped nature and his own history through his activity and thought. The misrepresentation, I think, goes back to Frederick Engels, his friend, benefactor, and interpreter. In 1885, in his essay on the history of the Communist League, Engels recalled his first extended meeting with Karl Marx in Paris 40 years before. He says, "When I visited Marx in Paris, our complete agreement in all theoretical fields became evident, and our joint work dates from that time. When, in the spring of 1845, we met again," he went on, "Marx had already fully developed his materialist theory of history in its main features. And these are two propositions which I'm going to question now. This was a truly misleading account. Marx and Engels converged on certain points of common interest, the espousal of Feuerbach, the adoption of a socialist rather than a republican agenda, and above all, an agreement about the importance of political economy. Engels' initial tendency to defer to Marx's intellectual authority also smoothed out some of the areas of possible contention. But Engels' intellectual and political formation was quite different from that of Marx, and the difference between them persisted. The accusation that in later years Engels distorted Marx's thought is quite common in the literature. The claim is generally made in vague and generic terms. George Lichtheim expressed the consensus view when he stated that the philosophy of the late Engels was heavily indebted to positivism, or Shlomo Avineri stated that the origins of Engels' views were to be sought in a vulgarized version of Darwinism and biology with a Hegelian terminology no more than a shallow veneer. These references to Darwin or positivism fail to get back to the root, I think, of the differences between Marx and Engels. Such differences were already present in the mid-1840s when they first met, and in that sense clearly preceded the impact made by Darwin or Comte. The difference was already implicit in the contrast between Marx's radical Hegelianism, evident in his dissertation on Epicurus, and in Engels' formative relationship, on the other hand, with Owenism. For Owenism was built upon the prevailing assumptions of Anglo-French sensationalism and materialism in the 18th and early 19th centuries, while by contrast, the most distinctive feature of Marx's writings, both in the 1840s and through to Capital and the writings of the 60s, was the creative, if selective, development of the legacy of German idealism. Engels' account contains two claims. Firstly, their complete agreement on all theoretical fields. Secondly, that between 44 and 45, Marx fully developed his materialist theory of history in its main features. If the first claim is to be assessed, we have to just briefly survey Engels' own theoretical formation. Engels was born eldest son of a textile manufacturer in 1820 in Barmen, Westphalia. Reacting to the strongly Calvinist household in which he'd been brought up, after reading David Strauss's Life of Jesus in Bremen in 1839, he gravitated towards the young Hegelians. He therefore chose to perform his year's military service in Berlin in the vicinity of Bruno Bauer and his circle. While Marx possessed the qualifications of a university-trained classicist, lawyer, and philosopher, Engels was equipped with the skills deemed requisite for a merchant. When Marx first got to know Engels, he was impulsive, intrepid, and eclectic. He had no contact with the university and no philosophical training. The growing disagreements among the young Hegelians appear to have made little impression on him. Until he joined forces with Marx in Paris, his journalistic writings showed no awareness of the growing rift between supporters, for instance, of Bauer and those supporting Feuerbach. He saw in them a common assault upon Christianity, which would lead to the replacement of theology by anthropology. Engels' understanding of Hegel was relatively superficial. His distinctive voice emerged not within the young Hegelian circles in Berlin, but in England, to which he had been sent to represent the firm of Ehrman and Engels in Manchester between 1842 and 1844. There he regularly attended Owenite debates in 1844, and in 1844 he was more conversant with Owenite philosophical assumptions voiced in the Manchester Hall of Science than with the philosophical tradition of German idealism. During his stay in England, Engels led a double life. As you all probably know, he was a businessman in office hours. He wrote frequently for the English and German radical press, and he was collecting materials for his book. Outside the office, Engels also developed a relationship with a radical Irish mill worker, Mary Burns, and got to know some of the leading Owenites and Chartists around Manchester. Much of the enduring interest of his book derives from these encounters and from the first-hand observation which resulted from them. Engels was impressed by the practical perspectives of the Owenites, but especially their rejection of political economy. In the autumn of 1843, he wrote his Outlines of a Critique of Political Economy, much of the material taken from Owenite sources, and that in turn is what made Marx gravitate towards the critique of political economy. After his conversations with Marx in Paris in 1844, Engels somewhat modified his position on England. He no longer just focused, like the Owenites, on private property, individualism, and social dissolution. It was now counterbalanced by an emphasis on the redemptive role of the proletariat, a theme which he had probably gained by reading Marx's essays in the Deutsch-Französische Jahrbuch. In the summer of 1844, he still believed, like the Owenites, that, quote, social evils cannot be cured by people's charters. But in 1845, his book criticised the Owenites for their disapproval of class hatred and for not discerning the element of progress in the dissolution of the old social order. The centrality of Engels' role in alerting Marxian socialism towards the revolutionary possibilities of modern industry cannot be doubted. It was Engels who first highlighted the position of the factory worker and connected the stages of the formation of proletarian class consciousness to phases of industrial development. His focus on steam-powered factory rather than the workshop also led him to emphasize the relationship between workers and the means of production rather than the product, and to describe the relationship between classes rather than the competition between individuals. His account made a deep impression on Marx, who almost 20 years later considered that the main thesis in Engels' book had been, quote, corroborated in the very last detail by developments subsequent to 1844. But Engels' impact upon Marx was that of an acute observer of social conditions in England and a prolific journalist whose writings had drawn from the Owenite and Proudhonian criticisms of political economy. It was not that of an independent theorist. The hollowness of Engels' first claims about their complete agreement in all theoretical fields in 1844 was apparent in their different reaction to the appearance of Stirner's Ego and His Own, a devastating attack on the moralism of Feuerbach. Marx and Moses Hess attacked Stirner's failure to distinguish the individual and the species as reactionary. By contrast, Engels' first reaction was to praise the book. Still closer to the Owenites, he believed that by a change of circumstances, Stirnerian self-love could assume the form of communism. The superficiality of Engels' understanding of idealism did not go unnoticed at the time. According to Heinrich Burgers, Marx's close friend from Cologne, Engels' quote, aversion to philosophy and to speculation derive much less from an insight into their nature than from the discomfort they have produced in his not very persevering mind. Engels, he thought, probably resolved to protect himself from this discomfort in the future by, quote, the exorcism of contempt and setting himself a descriptive task. But attention to Berger's comments was subsequently smothered, of course, beneath successive layers of Marxist orthodoxy. Engels' second claim, that by the spring of 1845, Marx had already developed his materialist theory of history, this, so far as it referred to any publications at the time, may have derived from Engels' reading 40 years later of the opening lines of a book called The Holy Family, published in 1845, where it was stated that, quote, the real humanism has no more dangerous enemy in Germany than spiritualism or speculative idealism. If this is the case, it would seem that Engels was conflating Marx's obsessive and mildly patricidal desire to differentiate himself from Bruno Bauer, his former Doktorvater, with a rejection of the idealist tradition as a whole. According to Engels, Marx developed his new materialist conception of history between completing the Holy Family and his reunion with Engels in Brussels in the spring of 1845. During these months, however, Marx didn't publish anything. All that Engels was able to find from Marx's notebooks at that time is a two-page entry called Ad Feuerbach, what became known as Theses on Feuerbach. This document did indeed refer to materialism at various points, but its main purpose was to criticise the passivity of the materialist approach. Passivity, he wrote in one of them, was the chief defect of all previous materialisms, including that of Feuerbach. Feuerbach was criticised both in the theses and in other writings of the time for the passivity inherent in his association of man with sensuousness rather than what Marx calls practical human sensuous activity. According to Marx, Feuerbach did not see that the sensuous world he invoked was the product of industry and the state of society, and that the social system was modified in accordance with changed needs. This criticism could hardly be construed as a contribution towards the, quote, materialist conception of history. As will become clear, this was a criticism which derived not from materialism, but from the legacy of idealism. Engels' elaboration of the second claim in his 1886 essay called Ludwig Feuerbach and the End of Classical German Philosophy compounded the error. He interpreted the philosophical conflicts of the period as a battle between two great camps, between materialism and idealism. This imaginary battle, because that's what it was at the time, imaginary battle between idealism and materialism was a product of Engels' conflation of the debates of the mid-1840s with the later debates based upon post-Darwinian materialism and the primacy of nature. It was quite remote from the substance of young Hegelian debates. A decade later, the misunderstanding that contained in Engels' account of the advent of the, quote, materialist conception of history was taken a step further in the work of George Kaplanov, the so-called father of Russian Marxism. In the Holy Family, Marx had attempted to apply the scholarly expertise employed in his doctorate to challenge Bauer's understanding of the Enlightenment. But Plekhanov misread this as now to make it an endorsement of Anglo-French materialism of the 17th and 18th century. The last step towards the invention of a new theoretical tradition was taken in the 20th century. The process was completed in Moscow between 1924 and 1932 with the publication by the Marx-Engels Institute of the so-called German ideology, presented as the second joint composition of Marx and Engels, in which Marx's theory was now called historical materialism and was propounded for the first time. The alleged first chapter was arranged by David Ryazanov and entitled Feuerbach. It soon became famous and republished innumerable times as a supposed resume of Marxism or historical materialism. But as recently been demonstrated by Terrell Carver, this text was factitiously put together by Ryazanov and his associates in the 1920s in order to satisfy the expectation of the new Soviet state. That expectation was that there had to be expounded Marxism as a system, which was done by linking up Engels' claim about the development of the materialist conception in 1844-5 with Marx's description of the process of self-clarification, so-called, in 1859. Well, once this elaborate mythology is dismantled, it is possible to uncover a very different account of what was distinctive about Marx of the theory that Marx was beginning to assemble in Paris and Brussels in the years from 1844 onwards. These were the years in which he established his intellectual independence from his former mentors, Bruno Bauer and Arnold Ruger, and also from Ludwig Feuerbach. Most striking was a novel vision of socialism and the proletariat based upon a new conception of the historical significance of labour. What inspired this new vision was not a putative materialism, but a particular appropriation of the basic assumptions of German idealism. This becomes clear when Marx's approach is compared with that of other radicals and socialists at the time. Their outlook was shaped by a naturalistic version of materialism. Their starting point, standard in England from the time of Locke through to Bentham, prevalent among the philosophe and ideologue in France, as well as the followers of Spinoza in Germany, was a conception of man as a natural being. This meant that man's actions were motivated by the pursuit of happiness and the avoidance of pain. And as a creature of nature, man was primarily defined by his needs and impulses. Throughout the 18th and early 19th centuries, this position offered a welcome alternative to the Christian Orthodox emphasis on original sin. Not surprisingly, this was also the founding assumption of the many varieties of socialism in the 1830s and 40s. And it was explicitly espoused by the two largest socialist groupings, the followers of Owen in England and of Cabet in France. In this approach, man was a product of his environment, a consumer governed by his appetites and needs. By improving this environment through better education and more enlightened attitudes towards reward and punishment, it would be possible to transform human nature and increase the extent of human happiness. Well, Marx's innovation in the course of 1844 was to apply instead the insights of idealism to the understanding of labour, to recuperate its emphasis upon activity and man's position as a producer. Most striking, I think, was the connection made in Marx's writings between two areas of discourse hitherto unrelated to each other. On the one hand, the discussion of the social question and the plight of the proletariat, which was very common in England, France, and elsewhere in the 1830s and 40s, and on the other hand, the world-transforming significance accorded to labour in Hegel's Phenomenology of the Spirit. By making this connection, Marx identified socialism with human self-activity as it had been invoked in the idealist tradition following the philosophical revolution established by Kant. Kant and Fichte had already challenged the passivity of the image of man as a natural being. But it was in the Phenomenology that Hegel, building upon this idealist inheritance, had translated it into a vision of history. According to Marx, Hegel had, quote, grasped the self-creation of man as a process, and in doing so had grasped the essence of labour, the creation of man as the outcome of man's own labour. Man, according to Marx, was not merely a natural being, but a natural human, but a human natural being, whose point of origin, he went on, was not nature, but history. Unlike animals, man made his activity the object of his will. He could form objects in accordance with the laws of beauty. Thus, history could be seen as the humanization of nature through man's conscious life activity, and at the same time the humanization of man himself through the formation of the five senses. History was the process of man becoming species being and the basis of man's ability to treat himself as a universal and therefore a free being. The idealist tradition was crucial in focusing upon the capacity of subjects to resist or override natural desires or needs and to submit those impulses to rational scrutiny. Already in 1786, Kant had reinterpreted the biblical story of the fall as a parable about man's escape from the natural condition. Despite his yearnings to escape, according to Kant, the wretchedness of his condition, between him and that imagined place of bliss, restless reason would interpose itself, irresistibly impelling him to develop the faculties implanted within him. It would make him take up patiently the toil which he yet hates. and pursue the frippery which he despises. Man's departure from that paradise was nothing but the transition from an uncultured, merely animal condition to the state of humanity, from bondage to instinct to rational control. In a word, from the tutelage of nature to the state of freedom. This ability to resist natural desires or submit them to rational scrutiny was what was meant by the term spontaneity in the idealist tradition. Spontaneity meant inward self-determination and was present in German philosophy from the time of Leibniz onwards and became the centrepiece of Kant's conception of practical reason. Its crucial political implications was that individuals might shape their actions not in pursuit of welfare and happiness, but in the establishment of morality and right. One of Hegel's crucial achievements in the phenomenology was to show how the concept of right might extend beyond the conscience of the individual and become embodied in institutions, in interpersonal relations, and form the basis of what he called Sittlichkeit, ethical life. The self-making of man by labour, invoked by Marx in the manuscripts of 1844, contained this vision of spontaneity and freedom as human attributes. Labour as a form of activity meant a continuous process of interaction with nature, but not one simply driven by need. For, as the manuscripts emphasise, it could also be associated with freedom, for man could shape things according to the law of beauty. As Marx later wrote in his initial draft of Capital, the Grundrisse, he says, "Labour obtains its measure from outside through the aim to be attained and the obstacles to be overcome in attaining it. But Adam Smith," he goes on, "has no inkling whatever that this overcoming of obstacles is in itself a liberating activity. And that further, the external aims become stripped of the semblance of merely external natural urgencies and become posited as aims which the individual himself posits. Hence, self-realization, objectification of the subject, hence, real freedom. Labor as the activity of self-directed individuals was a purposive teleological process. The resistance to be overcome by any labour process was either natural, the operation of causal mechanisms in the physical world, or historical, the conflict it might occasion with existing social relations. In this sense, human history might be understood as the continual and cumulative process of interaction between teleology and causality. In the light of this approach, the depiction of man as a passive being, as a consumer dependent upon nature to supply his needs, became Marx's principal criticism of the socialism of his time. This is why his so-called theses on Feuerbach, written in 1845, was as much a criticism of socialism as of Feuerbach himself. That was certainly true of the third thesis, which argued that, quote, "the materialist doctrine concerning the changing of circumstances and upbringing forgets that circumstances are changed by men and that the educator must himself be educated." It also explained, in part at least, Marx's objection to Proudhon. The labour question, Marx wrote, was not just about consumption and wages. The ambition of organised workers was not simply to attain, quote, "greater happiness through the acquisition of more material goods," but to change productive relations. True communism was, quote, "the positive transcendence of private property as human self-estrangement, and therefore as the complete return of man to himself as a social, i.e. human, being. A return accomplished consciously, and embracing the entire wealth of previous development." Well, during his time in Brussels in 1845-6, Marx elaborated his new insights into the into the constitutive place of labour or production in the self-making of man as a historical process. This meant a transformation of his definition of civil society. It was no longer conceived, as the Ionites and so on had done, as an aggregation of fragmented exchanges, each driven by their individual self-interest. It now became a relationship between producers. Such a conception provided a structural basis for the existence of classes. Labour was now placed in an overall social and historical process. The process and the purpose of labour was presented as independent of the will of the labourers, forming part of a dynamic vision of history underpinned by a succession of historical stages. In The Poverty of Philosophy of 1847, this made possible an altogether more positive appropriation of what was meant by the development of the forces of production and class struggle as the underpinning of the forward movement of history. He writes there, "No antagonism, no progress. This is the law that civilization has followed up to our own days. Till now, the productive forces have been developed by virtue of this system of class antagonisms." The sense of labour as the transformative activity underpinning the dynamic progress of humanity found its most eloquent expression in the tribute paid to the bourgeoisie in the Communist Manifesto. It accomplished wonders far surpassing Egyptian pyramids, Roman aqueducts, and Gothic cathedrals. In a mere 100 years, it had created, quote, "more massive and colossal productive forces than have all preceding generations together." The idea that freedom was self-activity, that the capacity to produce was man's most essential characteristic, had led Marx to conclude in 1844 that estranged labour formed the basis of all other forms of estrangement, and therefore that the whole of human servitude was involved in the relationship of the worker to production. For estranged labour was the inversion of what he called conscious life activity. Man's essential being became a mere means to his existence. Well, Marx never published his 1844 reflections on estranged labour, but the basic assumption remained. In Kantian terms, wage work was a form of heteronomy, an inversion of freedom conceived as the self-activity of the producer. This was another area omitted from Engels' picture of historical materialism, or the materialist conception of history. In Engels' representation, also, the frontier between humanity and animality was shifted. In Engels' Anti-During, composed in 1878, man, like nature, was subject to a Darwinian struggle, which only came to an end with the disappearance of class society. According to Engels, then the struggle for individual existence disappears. Then, for the first time, man, in a certain sense, is finally marked off from the rest of the animal kingdom and emerges from mere animal conditions into really human ones. Similarly, Plekhanov equated the state of productive forces with the, quote, struggle for existence, while Kautsky considered history part of of universal natural scientific laws of development to which human, animal, and vegetable were alike subject. Socialism itself was one expression of the universality of social instincts, which you could find not only among humans, but also animals and indeed plants. This form of nature-based determinism is not to be found in Marx's work, and is not related to the forms of belief and behaviour which Marx, from 1843, inspired by Feuerbach, had defined as abstraction or alienation. This was a product of culture, not nature, and arose in a situation in which self-determination took a perverse form. Man makes himself the victim of the abstractions which he has created and built upon these misperceptions. Thus, the teleological forward movement, together with the energy embodied within it, remained, But as Marx explained in the Grundrisse, it was complicated by the advent of capital, or the value form, which had come into existence as a result itself of human productive development. As it spread, it engulfed human beings and led to the loss of a human sense of mastery. Older systems of slavery or feudalism, where social relations were conceived in terms of hierarchy and subordination, gave way to a system in which products were sold in a free market and wages were the result of a contract freely entered into by masters and men. What emerged was a society based upon the universality of private exchange. Dependence was no longer between person and person, but upon a system perceived as alien and in no sense the product of the efforts of associated individuals. If freedom and equality associated with exchange provided the public face of society, exchange itself was only a semblance, the image of a process occurring behind it. It was a society in which humans conceived themselves to be the creatures of economic forces, and the relations between persons appeared to have been replaced by a relationship between things. But because this dynamic was the result of self-determination rather than natural determination, man retained the capacity to free himself or herself from the alienating institutional structure which had come into being with patriarchy, private property, and religion. And now I just touch another point where this conflict between the two outlooks is concerned, and this is in the relationship with Darwin. In 1883, at Marx's graveside, Engels did his best to associate Marx's work with that of Darwin. Quote, "Just as Darwin discovered the law of development of organic nature, so Marx discovered the law of development of human history." And the notorious partner of Marx's daughter, Eleanor, Edward Aveling, even invented the story that Marx had wished to dedicate Capital to Darwin. But this argument is fundamentally false. Marx's objection to Darwin was that Darwin regarded progress as purely accidental. Darwin himself did not believe that history possessed any unilinear meaning or direction. And he wrote in Descent of Man, "I believe in no fixed law of development." Marx, on the other hand, maintained that man was not simply a creature of his environment, as the Owenites and the later Marxists believed, and there is no evidence that Marx ever abandoned this belief, or abandoned the idea that history was a process of the humanization of nature through man's conscious life activity. While later admirers thought Marx started precisely where Darwin left off, Marx did not accept the fundamental continuity between natural and human history as urged by the Darwinists. He was happy to accept that Darwin's book, quote, "suits my purpose in that it provides a basis in natural science for the historical class struggle." But Darwin's theory could not accommodate Marx's belief that the first form of human society preceded private property, patriarchy, and therefore class struggle too. Class struggle and competition were not the results of nature-driven necessity, but consequences of man making his history in alien circumstances. Man remained not just a natural being, but as I said earlier, a human natural being whose engagement in social struggle was a product of distinctively man-made social and cultural institutions. Class struggle and competition were not therefore to be regarded as resulting from the inherent animality of humans, but from heteronomy, the shaping of their behaviour by alien forces. It was private property and patriarchy reinforced by religion that had reduced man to the animal condition of which class struggle and competition was the expression. Well, in the last decade of his life, This sharp distinction between historical and natural was recapitulated in Marx's mid-Victorian belief in the village community, a belief that was already beginning to look outmoded at the time of his death. But in this context, it is important to remember that Marx belonged to a generation of writers whose work on the transition from ancient to modern society preceded the impact of Darwin. Mayne, Bachhoven, Morgan, MacLennan, and Marx were all born between 1818 and 1827. All were lawyers for whom the study of early or primitive society was not a branch of natural history, but of legal studies, of which political economy in the 19th century was usually considered to be a part. The institutions upon which they focused, private property, the state, marriage, and the family, were also primarily legal in their definition. These writers who I referred to were neither travel writers nor social anthropologists in a later sense, even if Morgan made contact with the Iroquois and Maine became part of the Indian administration. Their sources were mainly classical or biblical. They drew specially on the Pentateuch, Roman law, and Greek mythology, from the patriarchal despotism of Abraham through the Ten Commandments and the Twelve Tables to Prometheus and the misdeeds of the gods of Olympus, or to the rape of the Sabines and the Caudine Forks. Fundamental to their concerns was an equation between history, development, and progress, whether from status to contract, or from private property to the end of human history, or from societas to civitas. All in their different ways believed that history was a means by which progress could be measured, a progressive movement from lower to higher stages of development, whether of forms of property, modes of production, types of kinship relation, marriage, custom, or law. The so-called comparative method was employed by them in different ways to assist the drawing up of developmental sequences. Well, in this talk, and I'm now coming to my last point, I've highlighted the importance of an idealist legacy and the ways in which it informed Marx's conception of historical development and the need, therefore, to distinguish it from the nature-driven teleology embedded in the so-called materialist conception of history. But it would be misleading to imply that all the problems surrounding Marx's picture of reality were the result of his collaboration with Engels. Marx had developed a post-Kantian vision of the role of labour in history and its capacity for self-emancipation, a vision based on reason, spontaneity, and freedom. But his adoption of this agenda was only partial. Most obvious was his silence about any individual right to freedom and self-determination. His position remained that which he had adopted in his reading in 1843 of the Declaration of the Rights of Man during the French Revolution. The rights of man were the barely concealed expression of the primacy of private property and the bourgeois individual in relation to the modern state. Similarly, while he ascribed a capacity for self-emancipation to the proletariat as a collective entity, he did not extend that capacity for freedom and self-determination to the plurality of individuals who composed it. In this sense, his picture of the proletariat was an ill-digested conflation between material need and the cause of freedom. In The Holy Family, he wrote that, quote, man has lost himself in the proletariat, and yet at the same time has not only gained theoretical consciousness of that loss, but is driven directly to revolt against this inhumanity. How this theoretical consciousness was acquired was not explained. Lacking private property, and also, as Marx liked to imagine in Paris, lacking religion, the proletariat represented the imminent embodiment of species being, the return of man to himself. But as individuals, they were accorded neither spontaneity nor self-determination. Their common consciousness was the result of a shared condition. Driven by necessity, they were presented as unreflective moments of the whole. Need would drive them to revolt, irrespective of any rational conviction they might have acquired. For, as he wrote in The Holy Family, it is not a question of what this or that proletarian, or even the whole proletariat at the moment, regards as its aim. It is a question of what the proletariat is, and what, in accordance with this being, it historically will be compelled to do. This was the reason why, a year later, Marx was unable to provide a convincing answer to Stirner. Vocation was ascribed to classes in the same way that Feuerbach had ascribed the vocation of individuals to become man, with a capital M. Like all philosophers in a post-Kantian tradition, Marx had acknowledged that man was both a natural being, subject to natural needs and desires, but also potentially a rational subject capable of subjecting those desires to rational scrutiny and of exercising his will in accordance with self-imposed rules and maxims. But Marx's proletarians lacked individuality. They were subsumed under the presumption of common interest and predetermined ends. Any aberrant manifestation of individual behaviour on the part of a particular proletarian could be ascribed to the pathology of estrangement. Not surprisingly, Marx's attempt to equate the universal path to human emancipation with the desires and needs of a particular class was one of the main issues in contention between republicans and socialists among the young Hegelians in the mid-1840s. Alienation, Arnold Ruger claimed, was not a condition which solely afflicted the proletariat. And more seriously, Marx's picture was open to the same sort of criticism which Bruno Bauer had directed against two of the former critics of religion, David Strauss and Ludwig Feuerbach. They had employed a pantheistic notion of immanence derived from the metaphysics of Spinoza to explain the displacement of Christianity by humanism or species being. In Bruno Bauer's view, what that had meant was that it had meant invoking a universal species being which was immediately effective without showing how it operated, how it was taken up, or how it was internalized by any individual consciousness, self-consciousness. Marx's notion of proletarian class consciousness was susceptible to the same sort of criticism. But in his case, the source of his position seems not to have derived from any affinity to Spinoza or any other nature-based determinism. In Marx's case, the obstacle to a full acceptance of the Kantian conception of the individual appears to have been the result of an enduring, passionate, and uncritical devotion to Hellenism, to an Aristotelian vision of man as a social being, as it had been conjured up by the Weimar writers in their imagination of the Greek polis. There was no distinction between the individual and the citizen in the politics of Aristotle. It was the fall of the polis and the coming of Christianity which had produced the emergence of the individual as a being apart from the citizen in civil society. But now, the social question and the advent of the proletariat contained the promise that once more this division could be at an end. Thank you very much.
So thank you very much. We've got a good chunk of time for questions. So I'll just let you settle in there. So can I ask if we have any questions for our speaker? Yes, just before you ask, could you just say who you are and where you're from, just so that we know, please? And wait for the... Yep.
Well, who am I? I'm Alan Hooper. Where am I from? Nowhere in particular, I think. Does it matter where I'm from? But anyway, no, having had the benefit of reading your book, It seems to me that you focused only on one part of the book, which is obviously the 1840s, which you've explained very fully and interestingly. But in your book, you also, in general, it seems to me you're pains to diminish Marx, which I don't find myself wholly attractive. But nevertheless, you praised him very highly in the 1860s, it seems to me, during the period of the International Working Men's Association, which, of course, he was the secretary, for his constructive relationship with trade unionists. Now, wouldn't that go some way to answering your implied criticism of Marx from his work in the 1840s, that in fact he was dealing with what you're describing as individuals with rational needs, seeking collectively to organise in pursuit of those needs, rather than operating, which one could concede, perhaps he did in the 1840s, with a conception of a sort of eschatology of imminence, you know, which clearly does open itself to the charge of how is it going to happen. So, in other words, it seems to me you've only given us part of the story you give of Marx by neglecting what, in my view, is the more interesting part of your book, or certainly as interesting as what you've talked about today, the work on the 1860s. Could you say something about that?
Well, 1860s, I agree with you that the part of his work where I think he comes closest to some understanding of the politics of the time and is in tune with them is in his relationship with the International Working Men's Association around the time of the Second Reform Bill. And I wasn't explicit, but there was a contrast which I was making between what I thought were very often a very stylized and static connection or unmovable connections in the 1840s, been a certain sort of Jacobinism and or socialist Jacobinism and an unwillingness to depart from them, whereas in the 60s he becomes a bit more flexible. And one of the things that I think is very interesting is that particularly this again goes against the idea of Marxism, that even the Marx-Engels Gesamtausgabe, which is the scholarly version of Marx's works, left out one of the most interesting little items in the 1860s, where Marx meets some trade unionists north of Bremen, I think, and says to them, well, actually, parties, they come and go. They're not so important. What matters are trade unions, because trade unions are actually in touch with the workplace and the real conditions daily that working class people have to deal with. So I think there are various ways in which he's more in touch with what is happening at that time. And I think the other way in which the 1860s is very interesting, whereas in it would be easy for Marxists and Leninists and so on to relate his work in 1840s and 1848 to a sort of more or less Bolshevik idea of what revolution was as cataclysmic events and so on. What I think he's more interested in, not only in the Second Reform Bill period, but also in writing Capital, is revolution as a process. Because if you look at his treatment of, as it were, a transition from feudalism to capitalism, it's taking 100 or 200 years. And 1688 is only one ratification of the change. And he's trying to draw out an analogy by looking at factory legislation, the reports of medical officers of health and so on, to suggest that a similar transition is beginning in the case of capitalism to post-capitalism. And I think that is a very interesting moment in his thought, and one, of course, which would have received a very different interpretation had Marx been able to publish the whole of Capital in 1867, rather than leaving it till after his death, and the two further volumes being a question then of all sorts of quite different interpretations as to capitalism, collapsing of its own accord. We can talk about that as well. Yes.
Okay, this gentleman over here.
My name is Yoav Pered. I'm a Liverium visiting professor at the University of Sussex. I didn't quite understand your point about the German ideology as a refutation of Engels's claim that Marx already had a systematic system of thought in 1845. If indeed it was the German ideology was produced by Riazanov, in what way do you argue was it a distortion of Marx's ideas in 1845? Only in the fact that Marx's ideas in 1845 were not systematized yet, or is in the German ideology as we know it a distortion of what Marx's ideas were in 1845?
Well, as far as I can make out, and I'm relying very much on Terrell Carver and his associates, scraps of different bits of citation are put together into this chapter, which then becomes or comes to look like a systematic exposition of what is then called historical materialism. It's not that they've made it all up, but it, in its systematic form, I think it is not the product of Marx or Engels, but the product of the 1920s.
Yes, gentlemen with glasses, just wait for the microphone.
My name's Michael Williams. Could you elaborate on what you were saying about Marx's theory of transition from capitalism to socialism? Because it seems to me that he had a number of different theories of transition at different times, and I'd like you to hear you expand on that. And, you know, what was his theory of transition within a capitalist society that was developing democratic institutions, as they were starting to do by the end of his life?
Well, I mean, his view is not a stable one, because I've given one around 1867, but the aftermath of that story was that the trade unionists, once they'd gained the Second Reform Act, seemed much less interested in the international implications of the movement than they had before, and they stopped attending the meetings, basically, to such an extent that in the end Marx himself wants to, as it were, somehow dismantle the international because it's not doing what he originally wanted it to do. At the same time, he goes then, perhaps it's because of, you know, the commune, he gets a very disenchanting picture, if you like, of English reactions to the commune, where, unlike a few years previously, when the Italian Risorgimento was a huge cause of enthusiasm on London streets, where the American Civil War seemed like a victory of progress over slavery and so on, where the Poles were going to dismantle the Russian autocracy, all that in the early to mid-60s. By the time you get to the commune, there's a very frosty reception from English press, but also the English trade unions, for what the communards were doing. Marx, at that point, sort of gives up, really, on English workers. He thinks they've been corrupted in some sense. And the only chance would to get them going again would be to foment a rebellion in Ireland. And he has a moment of sort of enthusiasm for Fenianism. And in around 1868, I think, 9, there is indeed a not very formidable, but anyway worrying to the English government and to the English population, rising in Ireland. And then some of the persons who've been responsible for that get sent to Clerkenwell Prison, and then they, in trying to escape, they actually blow up and, of course, cause some casualties, some deaths and so on. So it's a very disenchanting process, both in terms of English-Irish relations, and the Irish themselves give up the sort of insurrectionary route and go for home rule instead. So the whole thing is rigged against him, he thinks. And the other point, of course, is that in general, Marx really quite likes Disraeli, because Disraeli is pro-Turk. And on the other hand, he loathes Gladstone because Gladstone is, you know, a friend of the Russians, he thinks. So the actual split in the international is one where Marx proposes a motion in which Gladstone has deliberately insulted the British people by his actions in Ireland and so on. And this is something which the English trade unionists just won't accept, nor will most of the others for that matter. And so that's the point at which I think he loses any sense of optimism about what's going to happen in England and begins to think about transitions elsewhere as being more hopeful. Interestingly, it's the moment, too, where he gives up the idea that something like British rule, colonial rule or something, is going to be a progressive force because it's going to dismantle ancient institutions. And he begins instead to associate himself with movements of resistance to colonialism and imperialism and so on, and thinks that such societies might stand a chance of surviving through to post-capitalism without having to go through a capitalist stage. So in these last years of, last decade of his activity, this is the sort of direction in which he's travelling. And incidentally, just to as a compliment to the story I've been telling in the paper, the last 5 or 6 years he won't show any of his work to Engels. And Engels is very shocked to see it when, you know, he has to sort of clear the papers up after Marx's death.
Okay. It's all gentlemen, but there's a gentleman up the back.
Brendan Hogan, New York University. Thanks very much for your paper. I appreciated especially the reconstruction of the active agent in the early economic and philosophic manuscripts, the concept of spontaneity. But was I right to sort of hear a certain critical comment on a certain loss of the individual agent in Marx's explanatory schema of historical materialism as he developed? I mean, I'm wondering in what sense, from your comments and what you think about the role of the individual in Marx's sort of explanatory schema, and were you suggesting that something like a methodologically individualist alternative to historical and economic change is a better candidate for a certain scientific understanding of how there are transitions from epoch to epoch and these types of things? I'm just curious where you stand on that.
Well, I think it is a weakness of his thought that he makes a certain reading in 1843 about what had happened when the Greek polis fell, as it were, and you get the Roman Empire and you get Roman law and you get Christianity. And that's all connected among the young Hegelians with how awful Christianity is. And in his case, it's connected with the sense in which wonderful Greek ideas, not only of religion, which is no religion at all, he thinks, but also beauty. Look at their statues and all that sort of thing. Look, in contrast, this is what he's writing, look at Christian art, and you see these thin, distorted figures, ugly, no sense of grace, no sense of the ideas of humanity. So, I mean, he's absolutely opposed to what's happened since, you know, the fall of the polis, which excludes quite a lot of history. And it also leads, I think, to his difficulty in actually coming to any real positive conception of individual difference and pluralism. And when we get to 1848, for instance, the idea that individuals may differ, that classes aren't just, as it were, solid blocks who behave in this way or that, something he finds very difficult to accommodate. And again, with I mean, you can find the odd mention of, say, trade unions, but again, he's probably thinking of delegates rather than representatives. So he never accepts whatever Burke said about, you know, the representative nature of parliamentary democracy. In that sense, he's got a very sort of wooden and not very imaginative or just hostile idea of individuals as opposed to a collectivity.
Okay, this lady on the side here.
Hi, my name is Samuel. I'm just a member of the public, really.
Could you just speak up a bit? It's a bit hard to hear.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I think, well, Karl Marx, it's very relevant at this time, you know, in our time right now. We can see there is a consciousness for revolution. When we think of the austerity and just how things are politically, we can see in America, you know, the protests that are going on. People do want change. So I think, you know, what he said about the means of production and when we think about ownership, that's very relevant. You know, only, I don't know if it's 5% or something, owns 85% of the wealth. So everything that he said really is very relevant for our time, and I think people do want change. You know, they do want, maybe there will be a revolution. People, I think with the 5th of November now, is seen as a date that is very connected with that consciousness for revolution, you know, and if you take it back, I don't know, it was 400 years ago, people wanted change then. I mean, I went a different way about it, but, you know, it's really all to do with that consciousness for revolution. And I still think there is very much class divisions, you know. It isn't gone away. In fact, I would say it's more relevant now than it's probably ever been.
Well, I mean, after Brexit and Trump, I mean, anything's possible. What is interesting, I think, is that Trump, for better or for worse, has harnessed something about the angry feelings of a whole group, mainly of white workers, but not exclusively so. It includes American women, white women as well, but not women of colour, I think. The point is that there is some sort of seething discontent which has been exposed by both Brexit and Trump, also an inability of conventional party systems to deal with it. What will happen next? Your guess is as good as mine. Of course, we live in a profoundly unequal society, and that's one of the things that has led to the anger that people are obviously expressing. But as you no doubt know, of course, these things have to be, they're unlikely to succeed unless there's some sort of more organized sense of change than there seems to be at the moment, when what we're getting is either the plumping for some very simple sort of plebiscite type solution, which actually is no solution at all. So I don't know what's going to happen next, I suppose, is the end answer to your question.
Right. The man at the back with the mauve sweater.
Thank you very much. I'm particularly interested by the distinction that you make between history and nature, and whether or not it was at all obvious to contemporaries, whether any of them picked up on it. Because it seems to me that... obviously, the first part of your lecture was dismantling the conflation of the two or the elision of the two. For some of my sins, I'm interested not in Fenianism, but in Jesuit political philosophy. And Jesuit political philosophers in the 80s, in the 1880s, 1890s, and early 1900s are quite conscious of the distinction between idealism and empiricism. They see them as aggregated, but as something quite distinct. And I suppose the question is whether non-Christian thinkers who perhaps whether they were also reflecting on that conscious, what you suggest is a conscious conflation.
Well, I think what I try to suggest is that this conflation was an incremental process. I think there are lots of ways in which the differences between Marx and Engels wouldn't have been that great. But obviously, when seen through a certain sort of prism, they look much bigger than they otherwise would be. And I think what happened too was, or what aided that process, we're either talking about Germany and Russia in the first instance. And in Germany, I think it's partly the reflection or an expression of the helplessness of the German social democratic movement, which was getting larger and larger, but in a large bit of this period was technically illegal, wasn't allowed to say we're fighting for change and we would like to dismantle the state and so on, because they'd all be put in prison if they did say that. So what they resort to is saying that it's not us. Capitalism is going to do it to itself. Capitalism is going to reach a sort of a point of implosion. And it's interesting that Engels actually adds to that process, because in editing the manuscripts of what becomes Volume 2 and Volume 3 of Capital, he on the whole, is a pretty conscientious editor. But one of the things that Babel and other social democratic leaders keep asking him to do is, well, where's the denouement? Where's the bit where capitalism actually falls, you know? And I think Engels feels under some pressure to produce that moment. And, of course, it's been a frustration for Marx that when he was working in the on the Grundrisse and then the later chapters for the Capital, there was no such moment. There were moments, as Marx says, of course, you know, maybe profits will fall and this sort of thing, but the most that Marx can say is that at such a moment, Capital might be erschüttert, is the word, shaken. And it's one of the few interventions Engels makes. He crosses out erschüttert and puts zusammengebracht, i.e. enters its collapse. And this actually then fathers a whole set of theories which go right the way through to the 1830s or 1930s on zusammenbruch theory, theories of when capitalism is going to come to an end. And it also lets the social democrats off the hook, because they say, well, it's not us, it's going to do it to itself. And what we're going to do is then step in and put it all together again. I think there are various, what I'm trying to say in answer to your question, is that there are various circumstances of that period which are aiding the idea that it's convenient to think nature is doing some of this stuff rather than it's going to be historical initiative by human beings.
Right, Professor Hussain.
That's Atar Hussain from the London School of Economics. And just a question, the assessment of difference between Marx and Marxism has a long history, as obviously is a part of reflection on political events on history of socialism. So in that sense, I want to ask the question, that is, given this long history of this assessment, what is the significance of now turning to Marx as, you know, the difference between Marx and Engels? What are its political implications for the assessment of socialist history?
Well, I think the one of the points would be that very few people, I think, now believe in the Engelsian picture of dialectics and, you know, and its relationship to Darwinism and so on. So I don't think it has much implication. I think the points where Engels may be still of interest are he was a much better observer of day-to-day politics than Marx was. So as a historian, actually one can get a lot more from just reading Engels' journalism and the rest of it. When it comes to theoretical questions, I think probably what I've been talking about is now belongs mainly to the past. Although I was talking to some Chinese professors yesterday who are complaining that every university in China has to have a compulsory first-year course on Marxism, and all this stuff still gets laid out even though people don't really believe it. It's just one of those things like, you know, a sort of creed. So I think we're really dealing with a sort of skeleton. But I do think it's interesting the way in which that's what held communism and left-wing socialism together for so long, almost sort of 80 or 90 years.
Right, I'll just see who we've got. So we've got this bloke with glasses here, and
I'll go around again.
Thank you. You touched on earlier Marx's frustration in the later part of his life, with the failure of political events to turn out the way that he thought they ought to turn out. Did he attempt to reconcile actual political developments with his theory of political development? Or if he did so, in what ways?
I think he, in a sort of reluctant way, he does come to terms with the fact that things haven't quite turned out as he hoped they would. I mean, up until 1863, really, or thereabouts, he still thinks Chartism is going to come back and, you know, that the whole thing is going to get going again. Similarly, in 1848, I mean, up to 1857 at least, he's still thinking revolution is about to break out again in Europe. And he eventually sort of realizes that, you know, we're living in different times. In the 1870s, however, I think he's sort of given up on Europe. I mean, after the Franco-Prussian War, one thing which had always been a pillar, I mean, he always had this sort of enchanted fantasy about France, you know, because France was the country of revolution and so on and so on. And, you know, their main initial political effort is called the Deutsch-Französische Jahrbuch, the German-French Annals. And, you know, they derived it from Feuerbach, and of course the Germans were going to be the brain, the head, the spirit, and the French were going to be the heart, the woman, the female, part of this partnership between the philosopher and the proletariat. So that... And in the face of that, the French show virtually no interest at all in what Marx has to say, despite his French writings. It's not until really after his death that they even bother to translate some of his works. But he doesn't, on the whole, reflect upon why things didn't turn out as he thought they might turn out. Or when he does, it's they're sort of explanations which aren't really very convincing. Like, I mean, this idea that British foreign policy is governed by the Russians. I mean, it's just a sort of, and it has been since 1707, since Peter the Great, and so on. Yes, exactly. And so he's quite sort of credulous at this level. In his writing, too. By the 1870s, I think some of these things, well, we don't know, because he's more concerned about his health than anything else at that stage, so he doesn't write much.
Okay. Who are you pointing to? This young person over here. That's
yeah, we're in favour of the
So I think that might be it, but let's...
Do you think that social democratic reforms made by moderately liberal governments in the late 1880s, especially in Britain, had any kind of bearing on reducing the support for Marxism or not?
Yes, I do. But also, I think, you know, one of the things that is happening in the second half of the 19th century is a large increase in real wages, cost of food coming down. The so-called Great Depression isn't really a period of suffering mainly for workers and so on in Britain anyway, because, as I say, real wages are increasing. And so the sense that capitalism might be, you know, in peril, which had been there in the 1840s, really ceases to be there then, although there are sort of some panics about riots and this sort of thing. But I think it's fundamentally a very stable and rather conservative liberal culture that we're then dealing with.
Well, thank you very much for that. It's a most interesting talk. I mean, I think we've heard about the idea that we should try and separate Marx from Marxism. And in a sense, you started, I think, by saying blame Engels, but you went on to argue that Marx's attempt to separate nature and history was not itself fully developed, and in some sense we had to blame Marx too. The book that Professor Stedman Jones has written is on sale outside, and it's, as many of you will know, been subject to multiple and extremely complimentary reviews. So if you'd like to get a copy, it's out there, and he will be sitting here afterwards, and you can come back and get it signed if you'd like. But before any of that happens, can I ask you to join me in thanking our speaker, Professor Gareth Stedman Jones.